Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 21st, 2020. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly conference call, on the weekly call, top left-hand side, for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of the website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. On our scripture reading, we're going to pick up, well, actually, we were supposed to pick up tonight on chapter 19 in Matthew, but due to Christmas here, we're going to read Luke chapter 2. So Luke chapter 2, the Christmas story. Let me see if I can get this up. Okay.
Chapter 2. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Saviour, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which is come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste, and found Mary and Joseph, and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things, and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, as it was told unto them. And when 8 days were accomplished for the circumcising of the child, his name was called Jesus, which was so named of the angel before he was conceived in the womb. And when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses were accomplished, they brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every male that openeth the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. And to offer a sacrifice, according to that which is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. And behold, there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. And the same man was just and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel. And the Holy Ghost was upon him. And it was revealed unto him by the Holy Ghost that he should not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. And he came by the Spirit into the temple. And when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him after the custom of the law, then took he him up in his arms and blessed God and said, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. For mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles, and the glory of thy people Israel. And Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. And Simeon blessed them, and said unto Mary his mother, Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against. Yea, a sword shall pierce through thy own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed. And there was one Anna, a prophetess, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Aser. She was of a great age, and had lived with an husband 7 years from her virginity, and she was a widow of about 84 years, which departed not from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. And she, coming in that instant, gave thanks likewise unto the Lord, and spake of him to all them that looked for redemption in Jerusalem. And when they had performed all things according to the law of the Lord, they returned into Galilee to their own city Nazareth. And the child grew, and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And when they had fulfilled the days, as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. But they, supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business? And they understood not the saying which he spake unto them. And he went down with them, and came to Nazareth, and was subject unto them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature, and in favor with God and man.
Okay, tonight we don't particularly have a subject for tonight. We do have a speaker, Robert Schultz with We the People, is going to talk to us about a project he started up, and we'd like to try everyone to participate with it. And so we'll be opening his mic in a minute or two, I think. Before we do that, and also we should have Brent here. Is Brent here yet? Because Brent's probably going to teach us a little something today also. Have you seen Brent, Terry, or Jan? All right, anyway, we have any questions or any other announcements to be made?
Well, I have one question, John, and I have something I would like to read that came out of the Elk County, Pennsylvania Sheriff's Office.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Shall we do that now?
Yeah, whichever one you want to do first. You want to do the question first?
Okay. The question is, now that we have got a common law decision, can we get the U.S. Marshals to carry out some orders because these communists will not respond and they are still sending a thief and stealing my tools and clothes and plus kitchen appliances? You're looking for some teeth.
All right, well, you know, look, at the courts are totally corrupt. We've seen that over the course of the last 10 years. We've been in the courts, and it's been pretty depressing, right up onto the United States Supreme Court. They've been compromised, and I think recently we realized who the traitors are up there. You know, look, we're not going to get justice till we get to the other side, and getting to the other side ultimately is really when the deep state is taken out. And as President Trump has said, it's pretty deep, a lot deeper than I ever realized, and it's pretty wide, a lot wider than I realized. So it is spread throughout the states. We do see the problematic states with these Democratic governors that have caused havoc or allowed havoc to be caused within their states, and their resistance and all of the cheating and in the elections and so on and so forth. But I am convinced, and I'd like to say 100% convinced, that we will win this issue. President Trump will remain President Trump for the next 4 years, and I think he's going to make some huge changes, not only within our government, but also within the part of the government that is the judiciary. We have indicted quite a few judges, over 100 judges, over the course of the past, couple of years. We're gathering together a lot of papers, and we're going to be sending another paper into the United States Supreme Court probably in January. But these judges, and I think even the United States Supreme Court judges, I think we're going to have to consider indictments against them too. Congress clearly doesn't have the backbone to remove these judges, nor do they have the knowledge or the wisdom or the understanding of those who are, enemies, domestic, participating for whatever reasons. I don't think they really understand how serious it is and how much of a Judas they are, that they are selling out liberty. They're selling out America. They're selling out our Constitution. They're selling out the people. Until these people are taken out of power, we're not going to have any real justice in court. It is true that occasionally we get a win, and occasionally we get a decent judge, but that is extremely, extremely rare. We can count them on our hands over the past 10 years, on one hand, shall I say, literally. So that's how serious it is. I don't expect to get any justice for anything, any of the papers that we have filed in the courts. And we've got a lot of papers filed in. We have a lot of cases going on. We have many, I don't even know how many joinders we have, and habeas corpuses. And we're not getting anywhere with them because they are that corrupt. They maintain the status quo. They owe their allegiance to whoever it is that's running the show, the oligarchy behind the scenes, as they line their pockets. So, but I do have a lot of hope for January and into February. I think we're going to go through some chaotic times coming up soon. I've been talking about this for a while. People should make sure that they have enough food and supplies to get through a month. If you haven't done that, you need to do that now, because I think there's going to be a period of time where supply lines, food supply lines, necessities are going to be interrupted because of the havoc that I think is going to take place across the nation. Q has mentioned that this was going to be for a very short period of time. I think it was mentioned 10 days, potentially, 10 days of darkness, darkness ultimately is, I think they're talking about really the news coming out. And of course, YouTube and many places where we get a lot of our news, it's just going to be kind of dark, except for whatever, of course, the president is going to get out to us. I do think it's going to be a military correction. I don't see any other way. I've been back and forth on that, in my own mind, of course, on whether we're going to be able to succeed this way, that way, or another way. There's lots of ways the president can succeed at securing the office for the next 4 years. But I do suspect very strongly that Barr is not an enemy. This is all for show, to make the president look weaker. I never believed that Session was an enemy. But I could be wrong on that, but I don't think so. We do know that there's problems in the Justice Department. We know serious problems in a lot of government agencies. Because, again, things are that deep. I do not think that we can win this thing through the courts. The possibility is there. But just recently, I kind of feel it's not possible to get through the courts. It's not possible to get through Congress. It's not possible to get through a lot of the different ways that we can win this thing. There is no other choice. But for President Trump to really go forward with subversion and exercise his authority as president under those conditions. I am absolutely convinced there will be no martial law. Martial law has nothing to do with a free nation. It has to do with a nation that has been taken over. And there are a lot of problems with martial law. And I don't think he, as a matter of fact, I think I heard someone, well, a couple of people have mentioned that. I know Flynn, General Flynn had mentioned that, and some other people. And recently, trying to think of the name of the individual that's referred to as the Pen, P-E-N, just can't think of his name, John Bolton, that's who it was. He mentioned something about martial law, and the president did pipe in on that, something about denying that, and said that he doesn't know what he's talking about. So again, that may be a confirmation, I think, to us that it's not going to be a martial law situation. But I think the only way to deal with this problem, this is a complete takeover, a coup of our nation. If President Trump does not get in to office, then I think we're going to be experiencing the very last president of the United States. I think we're going to experience the final coup takeover of the United States by enemies both foreign and domestic. That's my strong opinion. And but I don't believe that's going to happen. Not at all. I know President Trump's not going to allow that to happen. I do believe that he's been planning what he needs to do for 4 years. And he had to make a lot of accomplishments in order to achieve and prepare us to be able to come out the other side strong and stable economically, politically, and with a constitution in full place. I do believe that that is where we're going to, and I do think it's going to go quickly. Q has made many notations about this. And, you know, there's a lot of other things we could talk about that, but I don't want to get into that tonight. And I guess we'll see how things go. But I do suspect very, very shortly things are going to happen. But it could roll into January before it happens, you know. But I have a feeling it's going to be before that. But we'll see what happens. But anyway, winning in court, we can only hold ourselves as much as we can in positions in our court cases. And really, we have to get to the other side. The injustices are unbelievable. All the people that they've put in prison on the federal level, particularly using U.S. C-26, you know, they put lots of people. They destroyed so many lives. But not just in that. Anybody who is a patriot standing up to these people, they have come out to attack them, jail them, abuse them. You know, I think it's time for justice. And I do believe that's going to happen soon. And I believe with all my heart, we are going to prevail at the end of this whole thing. All right. Anyway, I think we're going to have to wait for January, February before we can start get justices in our cases that we do have. And look at all of the cases that we have filed over the past years. They're still all in play. All the homes that have been taken away, all the suffering of people that have been in prison, all the people that are still in prison because they didn't respond to the habeas corpuses that we filed in all the federal district courts, and all of the judges that we've indicted because of that, their failure to give people their right of due process in a court of law. All of those cases, there is a common law maxim that says for every injury, there must be a remedy. There is no if, ands, or buts about that. There must be a remedy. And if that remedy comes 10 years later or 2 years later or 1 year later or a month later, so be it. It will come. And I do believe we will be able to go back and deal with the sufferings and making sure people get restitution, all the people that have suffered the loss of their homes and some of them their lives, unfortunately, and of course, being imprisoned. Justice is around the corner. There's no doubt in my mind or in my heart. And I do believe that the Bible supports that kind of thinking in this time in life, and I think we're at a very special time in this world. Anyway, with that, I guess that's are there any other questions?
No, that was the only question, John.
All right, and you wanted to talk about something. And do we have any other announcements before we go over to Robert Schultz?
Not really announcements. I just wanted to read this comment put out by the Elk County Sheriff's Office.
Sure.
And this is in Elk County, Pennsylvania. He says, the COVID-19 virus is very real, and we do have to be cognizant of the fact and exercise common sense practices to stay healthy, and to minimize the transmission of the virus. Over the past several months, most people have followed guidelines that were allegedly designed to minimize and slow down the spread of the virus, not to stop it. We were told that this would give the medical community time to tool up for the pandemic. However, as expected, power corrupts, and with it, our liberties have slowly been under assault. Because of fear and leverages of threats, people have willingly given up their God-given, unalienable natural rights guaranteed to everyone under the United States Constitution. There has been no concern with balancing safety guidelines with our liberties. Decrees and mandates have all been one-sided. The most recent restrictions and prohibitions have stirred me to respond. People have slowly acquiesced our God-given liberties without any real perception of what was slowly taking place, one decree at a time, one piece at a time, and one guideline at a time. What is of particular concern is that we have heard nothing from our local pastors as it relates to freedom of worship and our God-given rights. Many of the words and ideas that were penned in our Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution were first preached from the pulpits. These mandates that we have been experiencing have shut us up and gagged us from gathering in praises and singing, the very thing that moves God. If we remain silent, we can expect that He will also remain silent. It is time to draw a line and speak out. If our pastors will not do it, I will. When you look at the 20th chapter of 2 Chronicles, you will see that Jehoshaphat was informed that a vast army was approaching, and the entire congregation was struck with fear. They all went before the Lord. He told them not to worry and that the fight was His. Nevertheless, Jehoshaphat was told to go out and meet the army coming against his congregation. Jehoshaphat told the people to believe in God and they would be established, and to believe in His prophets and they would prosper. However, as Jehoshaphat went out to meet the invading army, he did something unusual. He sent men ahead of the army singing and praising the splendor and holiness of the Lord. That very day, Jehoshaphat and all his people watched the invading army destroy one another. They did not have to raise a sword or a single weapon. God moved with singing and praise, the very thing that our government leaders are trying to suppress. Might it be time that we do the same thing in light of the pandemic and everything else we are facing? I am also reminded of the words in Joshua 24:15, when he charged his people to choose on that day who they will serve, the gods of their ancestors before the flood or the gods of the Amorites in whose land they were. Joshua told his people that as for he and his household, they would serve the Lord. The people like Joshua chose to serve the Lord. However, Joshua warned them if they returned to serve foreign gods, he would bring disaster on them. No government or authority has the right to dispossess any citizen of their unalienable God-given rights. It is the responsibility of government to protect these rights, not suppress or take them away. The sole source of man's law is God's law. It is also known as natural law, which is supposed to guide government leaders in determining the standard of right from wrong. We the people know how to apply common sense. We know how to protect those who are at risk and vulnerable to any sickness. We do not need unconstitutional mandates designed to threaten and strike fear in people. How about we consider the promise of Psalms 91, where the Lord says that He is our refuge and that we will not fear the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. I call on all government leaders to turn to for answers where there is truth and to the person whose word never fails. The Elk County Sheriff's Office will not and cannot enforce unconstitutional mandates that suppress or abolish the rights and liberties expressly given by God. I also call on the Elk County community leaders and citizens everywhere to do the same thing as I have asked of our government leaders. This holiday season, stay true to your faith and hold fast. Sing, give praise and thanks at all times. Remember to stand, always stand, and never give up in the face of any crisis. And this is Todd Caltagirone. I probably butchered his name, sorry. He's the sheriff of Elk County.
Well, amen. What state was that in?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Well, amen. That sounded like a prayer to me. Very good.
Yes, did. Yes.
Yep. And, you know, with that, I'd like to just share that my strong faith in success is found in Isaiah 14. Anybody interested could read that chapter. It's parabolic, but I think it's pretty clear in my opinion. All right, with that, we're going to move forward with things. Robert Schultz is with us here tonight. Robert Schultz is the founder of We the People. He's done quite a bit in his life over the years that I've known him. And you know, he's taken the question, ultimately, do we still have a constitution, right of redress of grievances, to the Supreme Court, which they refused to hear. He also put together the Continental Congress. I believe they met in 2008, if I recall. Robert will correct that when he gets onto the mic if I'm wrong. I think it was 2008 or maybe 2009. I know the following spring is when we served it on every state in the Union, the state capital, to both houses in every state, and also to the governors, and also to the United States Congress and Senate and the President of the United States. And even that went, ignored. Silence. We met with crickets. But anyway, Robert, let's see if we can unmute you. I see you here right in the front page, so that's good. You should have an unmuted mic. You got the mic. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Good to be with you. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I know you wanted to talk about the petition, which we did put. We put a link on our front page here. Matter of fact, it's on every page. It's on the right side, right underneath the book. It says "Signed a petition to prevent the election fraud." And if you click on that, for those who have a browser, they'll see what's going through, and it'll open up to a page that Robert put together for people to electronically make a signature on this petition and read and get through all the information. There's a problem with your database out there, Robert. I'm wondering if they sabotaged it on you.
Won't open. How do you mean?
It says error establishing a database connection. Let me try it again. See if it goes through. Occupy theconstitution.org. So it's like, oh, there it goes. Okay, I guess it was just a glare clip in the database, but looks okay. Anyway, for those who are looking at the browsers here, you can see you come to this page, and you can review the petition document here, fill out some information for an electronic signature, and Bob is going to talk to us a little bit about this. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, so the petition, let's see, where do we, background, the U.S. Constitution, of course, is the supreme law of the land, and the people have the ultimate power in our society. I think we all understand that. Every clause, every provision in the Constitution is a right, a fundamental right that each citizen has. And one of those, in the First Amendment, there are five rights that are natural, God-given. We have them simply because we're alive. Rights that are listed there in the order that they're listed. It's, as you know, the right to worship freely, speak, freedom of the press, freedom to assemble, and criticize the government if we want to, as we may be doing here tonight. And also the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And the courts have defined the rights of the people and the obligations of the government under the first four of those rights. But no court has ever declared the rights of the people and the obligations of the government under the what's called the Petition Clause. And as you know, when you do not have the Supreme Court defining those rights and obligations, then what we have to do is look to the framers' intent. What did those words mean when they were added to the Constitution? And the Bill of Rights was added in 1791. Many states would not ratify unless there was a Bill of Rights, and that was added in 1791. I've devoted decades now to trying to restore that right. It was recognized and the full intent was followed until 1836, when the Southern congressmen prevailed in the House of Representatives in Congress. They did not want to respond to petitions from abolitionists seeking to end the practice of slavery. Until 1836, if any of us submitted a petition for redress of, say, a violation of the Constitution by the state of New York or the city of Albany or the federal government, unless the petition was totally frivolous or libelous, it always went to a committee. And every Monday, Congress dealt with petitions for redress of grievances. There's a law review article written by Akhil Amar from Yale in the 1980s. And he focused on the Connecticut legislature, colonial and later. And he documented that there was far more action taken by the government as a result of petitions for redress than any other reason. But all, as I say, all of that happened when Congress passed the gag rule. They passed a rule in the House that said any of those petitions from those abolitionists will be permanently tabled. First time government had gone on record and decided that they didn't have to respond to proper petitions for redress of grievances. And the history shows that that was added to the Bill of Rights purposely. You know, the framers knew that we, the people, who had the ultimate power in our society by design, should not have to rely for a redress of grievances on the electoral process or the judicial process, knowing as they did that both of those institutions were corruptible. I mean, they were institutions that could easily, and as we know, have become politicized. And the framers knew we, especially after Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which was published in January of 1776, a few months before the Declaration of Independence, but the framers knew that we should be able to hold our executive and legislative people directly accountable to the rule of law. And but it took John Quincy, after that gag rule in 1836, it took John Quincy Adams 8 years. He was president and then went back to Congress. It took him 8 years to get that gag rule repealed, but by then the damage had been done. And it's become all but the forgotten right. But for decades now, I've been trying to, I recognized in 1979 the need for the people to be better informed about their rights, better informed about what was really going on in government, and better informed, and they were obligated to intelligently, rationally, professionally challenge government when they saw government step outside the boundaries that we the people have drawn around its power. And I recognized back then, based on up here in Lake George, in the 1970s, the government here, the town of Queensbury in Warren County, were telling the people that this 32-mile-long lake was going to, in 6 to 10 years, in their words, was going to turn, quote, pea soup green, end quote, because people's on-site septic systems were contaminating the lake. And they were proposing a solution, run sewer lines down both sides of the lake, run it down Route 9 to the Hudson River, where they would treat, you know, build a treatment plant and discharge the effluent into the river. And they held a countywide referendum, 1979. And it passed based entirely on what the government was telling the people. It passed overwhelmingly. 3-4-1. The government was telling people, if the lake dies, tourism dies, value of your homes will go south, and so forth. And the day came when my wife noticed that in the newspaper there was an announcement that the man put in charge of this project, a guy named Norman Barnes, was going to be holding a meeting in the little firehouse around the bend from where I live. And I figured I had some questions, and I would attend and see if I can get those questions answered. One of those questions, of course, was... There was a new law on the books passed 2 years earlier in 1977 called the New York State Environmental Quality Review Act. And it required projects like this to undertake what's called an environmental impact statement, in which the alternatives are to be looked at, including the no action alternative, what's wrong with what we've got now, and to quantify the impacts of each alternative and compare the totality of those impacts and choose the alternative that would have the least adverse impact on the environment, taking the economy into consideration. That was a new law passed in 1977. And this was 1979. And so that was one question I had, and there were many others. So we went to the meeting in the firehouse, and when this fellow finished talking, I raised my hand to ask a question. His response, now this is a government official, and I'm a citizen, and I raise my hand, and he says, no questions. If you have any questions, see me later. I had no involvement, you know, in government before that. And this is a great surprise to me. Saying I was shocked is putting it mildly. There were a lot of people in that room, a lot of my neighbors and friends. I'd only been around the lake for about 10 years. So I nudged my wife and said, we're leaving. And she said, not without my covered dish. It was a covered dish luncheon meeting. And so I got home, immediately got on the phone and started calling people who I knew that had been around the lake longer than we had been and asking questions. Was there any algae along the shores? No. Was anybody getting rashes when they went swimming? No. Was there any restriction on eating any of the fish caught from the lake? No. What is going on here? So I decided to look into this. And what I learned was there was always a bill in the legislature back then that never was coming out of committee to authorize commercial casinos in New York State. We had them on Indian reservations, but there were no other or commercial casinos. And the people who own the principal tourist attractions at Lake George at the head of the lake, they had visions of Lake George, you know, having lots of casinos with all year round, lots and lots of visitors, and you needed to do something with the wastewater. Well, we'll sewer it. We'll ship it down to the Hudson. And how are you going to pay for that? They said to themselves. Well, we'll just hook everybody into it and charge them a fee. Why would people do that if what they had now have works? And they said to themselves, well, they don't know that. It's in the ground. You know, how do they know that? Anyway, so I did something that back then that I had never done before, never even thought about doing, never had an attorney, certainly never sued the government. But felt obligated and brought a case, and the complaint was that they were violating the law. The law was that they had to do an environmental impact statement, and they were not going to do one. And so we brought the case before the state Supreme Court justice here, and I started to learn something about the judiciary. He promptly dismissed the case. I appealed it to the mid-level court. When you sue government in New York State, there's three levels. The lowest level is the Supreme Court, then there's the appellate division of the Supreme Court, then you have the New York State Court of Appeals at the top. And so we were at the mid-level court, and that court gave me a half a loaf. They said, before this project can go any further, that law has to be followed. You have to do that review. And most people may have been happy with that decision, but I wasn't, because I felt the intent of the law was that that information had to be before the people, before they voted on the project. And it had to be before the town board and the county board, before they voted to approve and finance the project. And so I decided to ask the highest court in the state, the Court of Appeals, to hear the case, and they agreed. And in 1982, the case was filed in 79, in 82, the court gave me, in a very robust decision, gave me everything I was asking for. They nullified the results of the countywide referendum and all the resolutions passed by the town and county in approving and financing the project. And eventually, a full-blown environmental impact statement was undertaken, paid for by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and we had a citizens' council, a citizen group, that was keeping tabs on everything and being very much involved. And the bottom line of that review was the last thing you want to do around Lake George is add any sewers. It turns out most of the pollution of Lake George comes from dry fall and wet fall, right out of the atmosphere, when it's raining or not. And those of you who have been at the lake, you know, you stand at the down on the beach road, down in the village of Lake George, and you look up the lake, and it's stunning. The beauty, the hillsides on both sides are undeveloped for the most part. There's spotty little things here and there, but basically it's undeveloped. And the reason for that is there are no soils on those hillsides to handle people's on-site septic wastewater if they were to build there. But if you ran a sewer line down 9L on one side of the lake and 9N on the other side of the lake, then you could just develop the hillsides. People just could gravitate their septic and their waste down gravity down to the line in the highway, and off it goes, pumping stations. So so we prevailed on. And obviously, if that happened, you would replace a lot of soil and fauna, foliage, with impermeable surfaces, rooftops, driveways, and the rest of it. And that dry fall and wet fall, that pollution, then would have a straight shot to the lake. So that's what was determined during that major environmental review of the project. But it changed my life. I learned then and there that government is not always benevolent, that government doesn't always have the public interest uppermost in its minds, and they're not above manufacturing a crisis and concocting, prescribing a solution that is going to benefit a few of them and their friends, but at everybody else's expense. And that the people have to be watchful. The people have to be aware of, better informed about what their rights are and what's really going on in government. And I was at that time very disturbed to learn that in 1947, there was a law passed by the New York State Legislature, signed into law by the governor. It's now Section 801 of the state education law. And this is what it says. I'm quoting. All the teachers of this state will teach all the children of this state in public and private schools from grade 8 on, so over a 5-year period. What? I'm still quoting. They will teach them the history, the meaning, the significance, and the effect of every provision of our state and federal constitutions and the Declaration of Independence. Now, my wife and I graduated high school in 1957. We weren't taught. I didn't know there was a state constitution until I was 51 years old. My kids and grandkids haven't been taught. Each rising generation was supposed to have been taught. I have a case now against New York State. I have four cases in trying to restore this right to petition. And the one against the state is for, you know, there are four violations of the Constitution and the law. One of those is that they have this law that they have been violating, not they haven't been teaching. If people don't know there's a state constitution, then how do you know if your mayor, your county board, the governor, are doing something that they're prohibited from doing? The state constitution is a set of do's and don'ts. It's the people instituting the government here and telling him what they can and cannot do. Now, how do you know if what they're doing is prohibited or mandated, or not doing and mandated, if you don't know this is state constitution? You know, as an exhibit in this current case we've got against the state, we have the I think it's 150 pages, the curriculum, social studies curriculum for grades 9 through 12, it doesn't even mention the state constitution. It's pretty obvious. The government does not, the constitution, state and federal, it's all about power between the people and the government that the people institute. And the government obviously doesn't like to be told what they can and cannot do. So, anyway, that woke me up, that case that we won back then. And I decided I had a very good career, very lucrative career going. I was raising thoroughbred horses up here at 160 acres on the, up here on the east side of the lake, and raising horses, sheep, and kids, and having a good life. But this changed my life. It took about 7 years to make the transition entirely away from my prior career to doing this full time. But I was curious about the framers. I was curious about the history of America. It took me to places like Monticello, Jefferson's home. I remember there was a book on the bookstand down there called The Constitutional Thought of Thomas Jefferson. And I thought, wow, that's going to be way over my head, you know. And so I went and walked around the place, visiting the place, and kept thinking about that book. And I finally went back and bought it. And I said, well, when I have nothing else to do and got plenty of time to get into the constitutional thought of Thomas Jefferson, well, I'll get into this book. And sure enough, it took a little while, but the day came. And the first four chapters were on about republicanism, small r, obviously, the philosophy, not capital R, the party. And I was just as angry then, you know, why haven't I been taught? I've graduated one of the federal academies, one of the five federal academies, with an engineering degree, got a master's degree. I completed just about all the coursework for a PhD in public administration. How come I didn't know these things? And how come I didn't know there was a state constitution until I was 51 years old? And so that led to, during the case against Warren County on the Warren County Sewer Project, I walked around, knocked on doors, formed the Tri-County Taxpayers Association. We decided we would have an organization that would monitor what government was doing in these three counties and do what we could to hold them accountable to the law. And then in 1990, and there were a number of lawsuits that we were bringing. I decided I didn't have any background in this, but I was doing the legal work. And these cases had, you know, multiple plaintiffs, all each pro se, each representing themselves. And in 1990, there was a question going on the state ballot. The New York State Constitution states plainly that before the government, either state or municipal government, borrows money, it has to get the voters' approval. And so there was a question on the ballot asking the voters if they would approve the state borrowing $1.9 billion. And my wife brought me the mail one day, and there was a letter there addressed to homeowner. These letters were going out all over the state to homeowners, and inside there was a letter from a state official, and there was a pamphlet. And in the pamphlet there was a quote from Governor Mario Cuomo, in which he said, a vote for this, they call it Bond Act, would be the ultimate selfless act. And I just instinctively felt, wait a minute, that's not my idea of the ultimate selfless act. And what he's doing here is basically using my money to print this thing and postage and whatnot, to persuade people to vote yes, to influence them, to influence the vote. And again, I instinctively felt that there was something wrong with that. And so I went back to the law library and was rummaging around. And I came across a decision by a Supreme Court justice in Manhattan. It had to do with the Equal Rights Amendment that we went through at that time. And in it, he happens to mention something I had never heard of at the time. This is 1990. I'm 51 years old. He mentions the New York State Constitution. And I say, what the hell is that? I just thought we had these statutes that I was defending, like the State Environmental Quality Review Act, and that above all of that was the U.S. Constitution. I just didn't know. And so I looked up, and there was McKinney's, and there was the Constitution. So I got it and started going through it. And all I could find was a provision in the state constitution that prohibits the giving or lending of state money or credit in aid of a private undertaking. So I said, is this a public or private undertaking? It has all of the trappings of a public undertaking in that the legislature put the question on the ballot, and this letter and this pamphlet is coming from the governor, the state, but I wasn't sure. And so I turned my attention to a set of books called New York Jurisprudence. If you want to know what any law is in the state, you can turn to New York Jurisprudence. And so sure enough, what I learned was that any matter on the ballot is a private matter until it passes. And only then do we, the people, give up a little bit more of our power to whatever it is that's on the ballot, whether it's John Duresh seeking public office, that's a private matter until it passes, or whether it's your local school district asking for $1 million to add a wing on the school. That's a private matter. And the Constitution says you can't use public money in aid of a private undertaking. So there was, you know, there was my, that's what I had to do. I had to defend that provision of the Constitution against this violation. So I drew the papers up, and when you sue the state, you have to do it in Albany. Previous to that, the cases we were filing were up here. And there are a lot more judges in that area than there are up here. And so I just picked one that I only had to walk up one flight of stairs, and it was Judge Lawrence Kahn's office and his chambers, and knocked on the door, was told to come in, went in, and there was a secretary there. Her name was Elaine. And I started approaching her when this man came down the inner hallway. It was Judge Kahn. He didn't have a robe on, but he said, "What have you got there?" And I said, "It's a show cause order." And he said, "Who's that against?" And I said, "The governor." And his response immediately is, "What's he doing now?" I said, "Well, he's using my money to tell me how to vote." I was very nervous. I mean, I'd never done things like this before. And he looked at me. Our eyes met. And he says, "They do that all the time, don't they?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but he's doing it here." Long story short, he told me to get on the phone and get the attorney general down to his chambers. So she called the number, and I spoke to one of the assistant attorney generals, and he asked my name. He had never heard of me, of course. I'm this guy that came out of the mountains. He asked if I was a lawyer, and I said no. And he said, "Well, put Judge Kahn on," and I did. Judge Kahn was listening, and then finally he said, "You got 45 seconds to get down here. If you don't sign, I'm going to sign this injunction." And the guy was there right away, and Judge listened to me and the assistant attorney general, and he said, "I'm with him," and he signs this injunction. And then it went a few days later or whatever, there's argument in the court, and I prevailed. And what's interesting about that decision was the reaction of the government. Basically, that case, Schultz v. State of New York, there's now case law that the government cannot use public money or credit in aid of any private undertaking. And unfortunately, the reaction of our government here in the state was, well, if we can't encourage people to vote yes when we need to borrow money, we won't ask for their approval. We'll just go do it. Well, of course, there's a provision in the Constitution that prohibits the state from borrowing money without voter approval. And so that question went down to defeat primarily because that decision in the Schultz case made the editorial pages all over the state. And in the event, it went down to defeat. Well, the government came right back with a law that would have the Urban Development Corporation issue $283 million in bonds, take the proceeds, put it in the state treasury, and get the deed to Attica Prison, a prison we built and paid for in 1931. So it's the state buying Attica Prison from itself, basically, a gimmick. And they would lease it back to the state. The law said, you know, they were not to expend any money painting the walls or feeding the prisoners, nothing. Just lease it back, and the lease payment would equal the principal and interest on the debt. So, of course, I went to court. You know, we, by now it's the all-county, the Tri-County Taxpayers Association formed in 1979, morphed into the All-County Taxpayers Association in 1990 when we brought that first case against the governor. So we brought the case charging the state with violating the provision of the state constitution that requires voter approval. And the state was, they were resting on some provision that had, that they had, I'm trying to remember, that'll, it'll come to me, but oh, yeah, there was a state finance law, section 123B1, and this is what it says. And this was the government's defense in the Attica prison case. There, the law says that citizens have a right to challenge the government on how it spends its money, comma, except if the matter involves bonds or bond anticipation notes. Then the court has no jurisdiction. Well, of course, that's nonsense because that's a statute that deprives us of a fundamental right guaranteed by our state constitution. And so I argued that, and it went all the way to the Court of Appeals again, the top court, and they ruled and said, no, that act cannot deprive an individual of a constitutional right. And they struck it down, but they went on to and said that I was late in bringing the case and the genie was out of the bottle. It's a doctrine called latches. And so they did not require, you know, that the bonds proceeds be returned. And then there was the third in the, you know, I call the trilogy of cases that really taught me how right the framers were when they put the petition clause in the First Amendment, knowing that we should not have to rely on the judicial process or the electoral process, that we should be able to go directly to these legislative and executive people to hold them accountable. The third case, and I hope you're sitting down because this one will shake you. All these three cases happened pretty quickly. In the third case, the legislature passed a law authorizing the state Thruway Authority and the state Urban Development Corporation and the MTA, another state agency, to issue $12 billion in long-term debt. I think the number was 12. It's a very large number. of course, without voter approval, they were doing this. And so this time there was no latches, there's no delay. I was right there in court challenging that act as a violation of the New York State Constitution's prohibition against borrowing without voter approval. And believe it or not, the state now hired Arthur Lyman to go against me. Arthur Lyman was a very big lawyer from Washington, D.C. He was, if you remember, the Iran-Contra affair. And when the Senate was grilling, had a hearing, and they were grilling Oliver North, the guy up on the bench on the dais asking the questions was Arthur Lyman. And they hired him to go against me. And he, I remember so clearly, I'm standing with him at the Court of Appeals, highest court in the state. There's seven judges up there. And he's saying, this isn't the debt of the state. It says so right here on the official statement that's being used to induce people to borrow buy the bonds. It's not the debt of the state. And I said, well, whose debt is it? I mean, I know it's a state agency. It's New York State Thruway Authority. And I said, well, whose debt is it? You know, and there was no answer. And he's saying in court, the legislature may not appropriate the money to pay these bonds off. And I said, that'll never happen. That's an admission that the New York State is broke. New York State has never failed to pay its debts. Never, ever. And if they did, if they didn't appropriate the money for these bonds, that's an admission they're broke, and that would affect the cost of borrowing for every unit of government in the state. That'll never happen. Anyway, Judge Kaye, the chief judge, wrote the decision. I hope you're sitting down, because what she wrote was, if the legislature appropriates money, and if that money gets used to retire any of these bonds, those will be permissible, she called them, in the decision, permissible gifts. And she wrote that the legislature is free to gift money to anybody it wants to gift it to. Oh, my God. And with that, I knew just how politicized, you know, that the judicial branch is not the independent co-equal branch that we may have been told it was at one time in our youth, you know, that it is politicized and so forth. And with that, I, you know, started turning my attention to federal issues and directing petitions directly at legislative and executive people, only with hard evidence that they were violating the Constitution or some statute, and then they didn't respond. Only then would I go to court. And I have four of such cases. I don't know. There's probably 200 decisions in cases that I have litigated against government wrongdoing, government violations of the rule of law over these 40 years. And it's all coming. I'm trying to restore. Basically, my mission is to institutionalize citizen vigilance. Get the people, retired, semi-retired people, in positions monitoring everything that's going on in their county, in their town, and at the state, you know, and have enough information to know where to look, and then how to prepare a one-page petition for redress. And the model I've had in mind is okay, you get these people submitting these petitions for redress, and they get ignored, or you get a non-answer answer, and these people will then submit it, send it to something I'm determined to see built before I pass, and I'm 81 now. A citizen vigilance center in every state, but certainly one here in New York before I pass. A citizen vigilance center manned with, and architecturally from the outside, I hope it looks just like Jefferson's home, where inside you have people familiar with the law, lawyers or not, and they investigate and they recommend a course of action, either legal action or civic action. I think the framers were right. Obviously, every right has a remedy, and any right that's not enforceable is not a right. And we have the right of enforcement. And, listen to the words of the delegates to the first Congress in 1774, the likes of Washington and Adams and John Jay, they're all delegates. Jefferson became a delegate in 75. But in 74, they passed the, you should Google the Continental Congress of 1774 and see all the declarations and resolves that these people passed. And one of them was directed to the inhabitants of Quebec, another geography that was under the hand of the same government that we were under back then. And we were trying to gain their sympathy. And in that document, the letter to the inhabitants of Quebec, signed unanimously, passed unanimously by the delegates to the first Congress. They said in this document, we're going to be talking about the great or the grand rights of the people. They talked about, I think, four of them, including the right to jury trial and stuff like that. But in that document, they said, and I'm quoting, "When rulers want money from the people and they have in any manner oppressed the people may retain their money until their grievances are redressed and thus peaceably," it's a nonviolent solution, "thus peaceably procure relief without trusting to the despised petitions." They had 11 years ever since the end of the French and Indian War. They had 11 in 1763. They had a period there where, after the war, France was gone, but England was left with these large standing armies, and they started to treat the people here differently than they were treating their people back in Great Britain. And all of a sudden, petitions for redress were being answered only with repeated injury. So they had, they knew that the government despised these petitions. So they said, when the rulers want money from the people and of any manner oppress the people, people may retain their money without, and peaceably procure relief without trusting to the despised petitions. A year later, Jefferson, as a delegate, wrote how foolish it would be to give up that right to give and retain money in defense of our rights. So anyway, I'm working very hard to restore the right to petition. And it's very hard for me to when I see government violating, you know, stepping outside the boundaries that we've drawn around its power. It's not something I can turn away from. It's just, and so getting back to the matter at hand here, you know, I saw I was watching the election results and just, you know, not, I'm just keeping up on it as, but not studying it by any means, and seeing all of the claims of voter fraud and all of that. But what caught my attention, I remember very clearly, I think it was a week ago Friday, Ken Paxton, the Attorney General of Texas, was on one of the shows, evening shows, in which he was describing a case that they had just filed in the U.S. Supreme Court. The state of Texas was suing four other states, four of these so-called swing states. And and I learned from his what Texas's argument was that there was a lot of stuff going on in the states, like mail-in balloting and abandoning signature verification, all those things, that the state legislature did not have any say in. And the point he was making was that there's an elector's clause in the U.S. Constitution. And the so this is a right we have. Every clause is a fundamental, is a right that we have, that the people have. And what he was saying was that this clause, this elector's clause, that it, I can read it here. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. So the state legislature by law fixes the manner in which the electors are chosen. As we've come to learn, before the election, there's a slate in every state. There's a slate of electors equal to the number of U.S. senators and representatives that that state is entitled to. So in Alaska, it's three, two senators and one congressman. In New York State, it's 29. Two senators and 27 members of Congress. But before each election, the Democratic Party chooses their slate of electors. And the Republican Party does the same. And then if more people vote for the Democratic candidate for president, then the Democrat electors, previously elected, the Democrat electors are those that are going to cast their vote. When the Electoral College votes, which they just did on the 14th last Monday, So that's how the process works. But the point is that the U.S. Constitution gives the states legislatures the power to specify election procedure in their state. No one else, no judge, no governor, no secretary of state, no election board, the state legislature. And so this was Ken Paxton's, this was Texas. They filed this thing with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has original jurisdiction when one state sues another state. And his claim was that in these four states, there were procedural changes that the state legislatures had not approved. It was not in law. And when I saw that interview, I said, now that's going to go so. That's a winner. But the U.S. Supreme Court voted 7-2 not to hear it. They voted 7-2 saying that applying this judicial doctrine of standing, it's not in law, it's a judicial doctrine, that Texas had no standing. Well, there's been a story out recently. I don't know how true it is, but when the Supreme Court justices went into their room, they closed the door and it's just them in there, and they talk about these cases that they're going to hear or not hear, that there was screaming going on in there that was heard through the wall, through the door, particularly Judge Roberts. And apparently the story goes that he said, look, my God, if we hear this case, I mean, this country is on the verge of civil war. And if we hear this case and you know, make a change, oh my God, the place will explode. No, we're not going to hear it. Yeah. So anyway, that's not the job of the court. The court is to apply the law, right? Anyway, so they dismissed the case for lack of standing. And I decided to take a look at the case to see if there are any individuals as plaintiffs, because obviously these provisions in the state constitution are individual rights. You and I have the individual right to have the states decide the manner in which the electors are elected. Nobody other than the state legislatures. And there were none. There were no individuals as plaintiffs in that case. So that got me thinking, okay, it's time for America to hear from people, not attorney generals, not judges, not politicians, but from the people. And so I got to thinking and started to work on a petition to the Congress, because it's up to, now that the Electoral College has voted, it's now up to the Congress. And on January 6th, they go through this ceremony where these boxes are brought in and each state's results, votes are announced in the Senate. And it's a joint session, and it's presided over by the vice president, who's president of the Senate, Mike Pence. And at any time, a representative or a senator can object. And then there has to be an automatic recess for 2 hours. I don't know what happens to 2 hours. Maybe they vote, the senators. I don't know. But so January 6th is the key date. And I decided to do some research and found an outfit called Ballotpedia. I hadn't known about them before. And they actually, starting last March, very professionally, irrefutably, you know, I mean, laid out facts that are irrefutable. Things that happened in all the states, or any state where anything that affected the vote, that affected voting.
Excuse me, Robert, you fell away from your mic a little bit. You're coming a little low.
Yeah, sorry.
That's better. That's better.
Yeah. This Ballotpedia did a great job. Short paragraph, the state, what happened, and the effect it had, you know, on the election, and the date that it happened, and the dates were hyperlinked, and you could go to the evidence. It was incredible. But anyway, there were 276 paragraphs in that report, which, by the way, is in a footnote, the hyperlink, the website, where anyone can go and see these 276 reports by Ballotpedia. And so I went through all of them very carefully and found, for instance, that there were some state legislatures that authorized mail-in balloting. And in other states, the mail-in balloting was not the result of the legislature, but, say, the governor or some official, you know, in the election board or whatever. And, well, that's unconstitutional. It violates, you know, the manner in which the electors were chosen, not by the state legislature, but by somebody else. And it talked, there were cases there where, you know, where cases went to court and some judge made a decision. Well, that's unconstitutional. Decisions that affected the voting procedure, decisions made by other than state legislatures, decisions made by executive or judicial personnel, is unconstitutional, according to the plain language, you know, of the Electors Clause. And so I decided to go to work and prepare a petition for redress of violations by the states of the Electors Clause and the Guarantee Clause. The Article 4, Section 4, as you know, state says that in the states we are guaranteed a government, quote, Republican in form. Basically, the rule of law, basically based upon the will of the consent of the people as expressed in their instruments, like their state constitution. That's what all that means. That's what it's always meant. And so I decided and I drafted, prepared a petition, and my plan was to take it down last Friday, drive down to Washington, it's about a 9-hour drive, and serve it on the Congress. But we had that, you know, couple feet of snow, and it knocked out my internet. And so all I could do on last Friday was call Washington, the office of my congressman, Elise Stefanik, and got right through, spoke to Stephanie, a woman named Stephanie in the office, told her who I was and that I had this petition, and was not able to drive it down. I wanted to get it down there. But so she said that she will call the Glens Falls office, let them know I'm coming, that I should go over there, and they'll scan it. It's the petition with its two attachments total 28 pages. The petition itself is 18 pages. And that he would, the office would scan it and send it down to her. So I did that last Friday, and then decided that I would hire somebody to put this on a website that I have a domain called OccupyTheConstitution.org. And over the weekend, that was all done. It was posted. People could sign it, read it, sign it. And we also have a statement of our beliefs there. It's all sponsored by the We the People Foundation for Constitutional Education, which is the organization that I formed along with many other board members some years ago. Anyway, so all of that was done, and then I just let a few people know about it. And my gosh, people are signing it in droves. I mean, all last night, today, it was only ready, you know, for posting yesterday, Sunday sometime in the afternoon. And but it's now on your site, thanks to John. You posted it, you know, on your homepage. And and by the way, I got an email. I want to keep politics out of this, but I did get an email today from Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, who is the chairman of the Texas Republican Party, saying they've got it and they're going to push it. So I don't know. It's out of my hands, but sometime before January 6th, I will have the task of capturing all these signatures pages and delivering them to Washington. So they now have down there the petition with just my name on it. But it does say that there'll be other petition pages will follow. And so I was looking at some of it. People all over the country, praise God, people all over the country are signing this. So we'll see. But the relief we're asking for is that Congress, based on these facts, I mean, sure, if the facts are wrong, tell us, you know, ignore it, whatever. But based on these facts, there were 31 states that changed the voting procedures that the state legislature did not have a hand in. And
you fell away a little bit again, Robert.
Yeah. So there were those, and the electoral, you know, there's 238 Democrat presidential electors, and from those 31 states, and 163 Republican presidential electors from those 31 states. They were appointed unconstitutionally by 31 states. And they're all listed in the petition. And so we'll see. The government doesn't like me. The government clearly does not want the petition clause even mentioned, much less restored. Because it will result in a very significant shift in the ultimate power in our society from the government back to the people where it was meant to reside in the first place. They know that, and they're doing everything they can to silence me, to silence the foundation, But onward we go. So, any questions? I hope people will read this, pass it around, sign it. It's 18-page petition. It's got two attachments. One of them is the historical record of the right to petition. And from that, you learn what it's all about, and boy, is the government obligated to respond. And then the other attachment is we're encouraging the Congress to do what they can to influence the states. They can't tell them what to do without an amendment to the Constitution, but they can certainly encourage them and do whatever, you know, influence, to see that this mess doesn't happen again. I mean, we need, obviously there's a lot of principles underlying our Constitution, our constitutional republic. One of those is what's called the public nature of elections. Elections, every step in the vote counting process is to be open for examination and observation, which means paper ballots, hand marked, hand counted, period. Not election, not computerized application of computerized vote counting or anything like that. And so the second attachment to the petition is to Congress to encourage, you know, and elections that are characterized as we characterize them in the petition itself. The next big task, I have a reply brief due to the Second Circuit here in a couple of days. That's got to get that done, and I'm working on, I'll probably have three, it looks like, if I can find the money and the time, I will have three petitions for writ of certiorari going to the U.S. Supreme Court at the same time, where the underlying question in each is the rights of the people and the obligations of the government under the petition clause. That is the issue in each of these four cases. In three of them, I think I have decisions where I can file these petitions for writ of certiorari. They're expensive because they have to be prepared in a booklet format, much less than 8.5 by 11, and there can't be any copies of anything in there. Everything has to be retyped in this format, and 50 copies of each petition, and so it's a lot of work, and hopefully I can get to it all. And because it's all, this issue is coming to a head now. There's a bright spot, one very big bright spot in terms of this meaning of the petition clause. In 2011, I argued one of these cases before Judge Sotomayor at the Second Circuit before she was appointed to the Supreme Court. I also argued one of these cases before Judge Kavanaugh when he was in the D.C. Circuit, before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. I don't know whether they have to recuse or what, I don't worry about things like that. But there was a bright spot 4 years after the Kavanaugh decision. The Supreme Court in 2011 issued a decision in the case called Borough of Duryea versus Guagnari, in which the Supreme Court said, in any matter involving the right to petition, we have to look at the historical scope and purpose, the origin and line of growth of the right. Praise God. That historical scope, that which a copy of which is attached to this petition, has been has been attached and made a part of every one of these cases for so long now. And now we have the Supreme Court in 2011 saying you got to look at the historical, because there's no case law. There's no case law. And, you know, Thomas Paine, the country now, as you know, is going through a lot of turmoil, to say the least. There's a lot of, I've never seen the level of vitriol that we all see today. Never seen the divisiveness. There's a constitutional divide that seems to be, some are, I mean, I'm of the opinion it's almost unbridgeable. We're getting to that point for sure. And and the country back in 1775 and 1776 is very much like today. I encourage everybody to reread Thomas Paine's Common Sense, the pamphlet that he published in January of 1776. There was a lot of turmoil in the country. I think the shots were already fired up in Concord. But there were those who were for reconciliation and those who were for separation. And Thomas Paine did a heck of a job of laying out all the arguments for separation. And he gave the people just what they were looking for, even though, you know, it meant picking up arms. He said so. But the point I want to make is, in that document, he speaks to, he talks about how the people were, in his words, quote, recklessly petitioning. You know, they would put these petitions on for redress of grievances, and they'd put them on a boat, and the boat would go over to England, and there'd be no response, or they responded with repeated injury. I mean, that's how I feel. All these petitions over all these years, no answer. We petitioned over the Iraq resolution, the USA Patriot Act, its violation of the Privacy Clause, the USA Patriot Act's violation of the War Powers Clause. There's no authority in the Constitution for a central bank, so it violates the Enumerated Powers Clause. The direct unapportioned tax on labor, no authority, you know, for that. And direct unapportioned tax on labor. So, you know, all of these petitions falling on deaf ears for years, not unlike back then. And so in his final paragraph or so, he says, we need a manifesto, you know, that speaks to these, the ineffectiveness, he calls it, ineffectiveness of our approaches, you know, of trying to, you know, petition and reason with the government. And of course, that manifesto turned out to be, a few months later, the Declaration of Independence. And if you take a look at the Declaration of Independence, 3/5 of the words are a listing of all of the grievances. And then after that list of grievances, the very next paragraph, it's two sentences. It's what the constitutional scholars call the capstone grievance, the grievance that more than any of the others resulted in our Declaration of Independence. And what does it say? quote, "In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned in the most humble way, and our repeated petitions have been answered only with repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which would define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. We declared our independence over their failure to respond to petitions for redress." You know, that right to petition for redress goes back to the Magna Carta of 1215. The Magna Carta was a charter. And in section 61 of the Magna Carta, the king agrees that if the people have, he says so, if the people have any evidence that the monarchy is not appropriately, or is infringing on any rights and not appropriately keeping the peace, they can petition us for redress of the grievances. And if we don't respond in 40 days, it goes on, and I'm quoting, the people have the right to take everything we own, I'm quoting, including our lands, castles, and possessions. Everything but my life, the life of the queen, the life of our children, and the life of the chief judge. Wow. You talk about the right to a response. And that right to petition grew in England. And eventually, you know, the right to speak, free speech, derived from that pre-existing right. What good is the right to petition if you couldn't speak about it among yourselves? And the right of free press derived from that pre-existing right. And the right to assemble, peaceably assemble, get together, as we're doing here tonight, and talk about the government and criticize the government, or whatever. Those each of those rights in the First Amendment is a distinctive right. And they speech, press, assembly, they all derived from the pre-existing right, the right to petition. You know, Thomas Paine made such a powerful argument that it ended up in the Declaration of Independence and then in our First Amendment. And it's no wonder that no court has touched it, because it's the right of the people to hold the government accountable. You petition them, you point to the law, you point to the facts, and you say, now knock it off or else. Wow. You know, and so no wonder they don't want that right restored. It's a wonder I'm still walking around, I think.
Well, so anyway, amen, Robert. And you know, as you were talking, I was going through some of the documents for those who are looking over through a browser. And we indeed, like our founding fathers, are standing at the precipice. But anyway, we do have a copy of Common Sense by Thomas Paine on our website. We have a lot of things under our educational tabs. We have the founding documents and so on, and the Declaration of Independence, Common Sense, and numerous other things. Of course, you know, we have the Bill of Rights and other things. We do have a few people in the queue if you want to take some questions. I don't know if they're going to be asking questions to you or other things, but we have a few people we should respond to. So once you finish up, and then we'll take some questions.
Yeah, I'm ready. I think that's about it.
All right, well, we appreciate it. It was really good, and gave a good insight on the path that you've been taking and where you've ended up. And, you know, you've left a lot out. The Continental Congress that you put together, which I was looking up, it's 2009. I had mentioned 2000.
Yeah, it was 2009, right.
Yeah, and that was really great. And, and of course, you know, the lawsuits you had prior to that back in the early 2000s, they were really good.
Right.
And again, you know, we keep getting slapped in the face, just like our founding fathers do. We are standing at the same precipice our founding fathers stood at. And,
we have the right of enforcement, and I am against violence. But
well, amen.
You know,
amen.
Withholding funds, you know, if the government seems to be violating a clear provision of the Constitution or the law, and you petition them and they ignore you, then what's the next step? It seems to me we have the right to withhold our money. You know, that's not the government we put in place.
Yeah, unfortunately, they'll just go out and print some more. And that's a problem. But, you know, look, at the solution, I think, is going to be military. I really do believe it's going to be a military solution.
I hope not.
Not military in the sense of violence in the streets as much as, or as little as possible, but military in the sense of arrests. And not only across the United States, but I think worldwide.
John, I believe it's up to us. We have the ultimate power. We just have to learn to exercise it.
Well, amen. And I think Trump is holding off on those issues and hoping for those things to take place. But
John, let me just say, one thing we've learned, individuals and small groups cannot prevail. The people have to put a collective foot down.
Amen.
Otherwise, you get screwed.
Amen. That's what National Liberty Alliance is doing, is trying to get people, and we are, connecting with other groups that are like-minded, that are compatible. I mean, we all have a little differences, and that's fine, but we're compatible, we're focused on the same end results, which is to reinstate the Constitution and apply justice in our courts, and that would make all the difference in the world. So, that's what we have to do. And I think this petition is going to help to bring a lot of people together.
Well, let's hope so. So I'll answer any questions. I've got a sick Sons of Liberty. I'm on there on Zoom with them tomorrow morning at 6 our time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'll be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Well, we'll take some questions here. Before I do that, is Brent here? Did anyone see Brent? Brent, if you're here, pipe in. And if he's not coming in as a host, Terry, maybe you could take a look to see if you could find him if he's here. But let's take some questions. We have a few people in the queue. Anybody else that wants to get into the queue, *6 and a 1 to get into the queue.
Yes.
We'll start off. Yeah. Brent is here?
Yes, I'm here.
How you doing, Brent? Okay. We're going to take a few questions before we turn to you and if anything you feel that you want to respond to on these questions, feel free to do that also.
Okay.
I'm going to take the next person, and as I do that, make sure that Robert doesn't get cut off his mic here, because that might happen, but we'll keep his mic open. Okay, let's take Jay. He's been in here for a long time. Jay, you got a question? Go right ahead.
Hi, Bob. This is Jay. I was the one that talked to you on the Thursday night meeting on the collective consciousness with Fred Smart.
Oh, yes. Okay, yes.
I've tried to sign the petition twice, and I got a copy of it from Fred, and there's a link to read the petition, and then there's a link to sign the petition. I put in all my information. I clicked on the box. I sent it off, and it says that my signature won't be added until I respond to an email, but I haven't gotten that email.
Yes, it is a verification. There's a privacy policy, so the emails are protected, but we have built in this verification step where and no one else is having that trouble, Jay. So I don't know why. Maybe you just didn't. I don't know how it shows up in your inbox, but it should have, and it will. If the email is correct that you listed, so I don't know. Try again. But
if you continue to have a problem, let us know. We'll get a hold of Robert, and he can get a hold of the text.
You should check your spam box because it could have thrown it into the spam. It does that.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't done that, but I know it's my email address because as soon as I start to type it, it autofills. So I know it's the correct.
Yes.
That's why I tried it again. After I tried it the first time, I tried it again, and I still didn't get anything. And this was a couple days ago I did it, and I've been looking every day.
All right, well, let's do this. Just for everybody, especially those who are watching on the browser here, if you've got a browser open, you go out to our website, and right on our right side of every page on our website, you'll find the Government by Consent book. And then right underneath that, you see sign the petition here to prevent election fraud. I don't know if you want to word that different, Robert, but that's what we have right now. And if you click on that, okay, you will go directly to the site where you can read and sign the petition. And the site is occupytheconstitution.org/presidential-election-2020/. Now, of course, you could just hit the link on our website and get there, but that's the actual link that this goes to. Now, anybody who does fill that out and does not get, and we expect everyone that's on the call tonight to do this tonight or tomorrow, get out there and get other people, get your friends, your neighbors, anybody else you can. We'll be sending this out also to our entire membership with 9,000 people, so we'll see how many people we can get up and get to sign. But if you are having problems and you're not getting the email, report it to us right away at mail@nationallibertyalliance.org. That's mail@nationallibertyalliance.org. And if this is a common problem, then we'll get a hold of Bob and let him know, and I'm sure he'll get a hold of his tech. So hopefully there'll only be a couple of people here or there, and then you'll just have to go back at another time and do it again. Sometimes when you have that kind of a problem, you might have to wait a couple hours and then go back and do it again, or even the next day. But get out there and get it done. And let us know if there is a problem. mail@nationallibertyalliance.org. Back to you, Robert.
Yeah, Jay.
And you're a little too far off your mic. Could you get back again?
Yeah, sorry.
There you go. That's good.
Yeah, Jay, I don't know what to say. Just try it again and again. We'll
wait till tomorrow, Jay. Try it tomorrow.
Well, I'll try it tonight because it was yesterday or the day before I tried it. Twice. So anyways, also Robert, I don't know if you've seen or heard our Quaranto that we posted in 2012, I believe it was. But we basically you should go on YouTube and watch that. It's National Liberty Alliance Quaranto, and we basically do the same thing our forefathers did, was declared our grievances, declared exactly how our forefathers did it, and read off the grievances. And it's pretty powerful.
Spell it.
Can you spell it?
Q-U-O, a writ of Q-U-O space W-A-R-R-A-N-T-O. You can find a copy of the filings up
Quaranto. Yeah, okay, now I understand.
Find a copy of that at nationallibertyalliance.org, and on the right-hand side, highlight grand jury, come down to action against the judiciary, and right on that page, you'll see a list of a lot of papers that we have filed, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 11 lines down once you see the Declaration for Restoring Order, and that was filed February 19th. Well, that wasn't 2020 when we filed it. We filed it a lot earlier. Well, this is a Quaranto on the Second Amendment. There was another one that we did a lot earlier, and there's two of them. There's one also to the IRS. But anyway, you'll find the Quarantas. There might have been a third one, because I think we did an earlier one also, so there might be three of them all together.
I think we did it in 2012, didn't we, John?
Well, it might not have been that early, but maybe 2014, something like that, possibly. But it should be on this page somewhere, because all the papers we file should be listed on these pages. I'm looking right now. We have the redress of grievances, which was a lot of papers that we filed. Writs and information, writ Quaranto. Here, it's 1505, so it's what, January, February, March, April, May 15th, 2015, the original writ Quaranto we filed. It's under writs and information on that page. It's about a third of the way down. And it says writs of information filed 2015 and 2016 in all 94 federal district courts. But we have a lot of papers we've filed over the years. And again, each one of these have gone unanswered. These were filed at the federal district courts, filed against the United States Supreme Court, and also a lot of other individuals. But it's really against the federal government, particularly all three branches. But actually, lately it's only been two because Trump has gotten in, and we've only filed some informations to him, and he seems to have responded to all of our informations. because we were just informing him of things, and he's been talking of those things. So hopefully he's been listening to we the people here at National Liberty Alliance. Okay, let's take our next caller. And are you done, Jay?
Yes. Yeah, thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Yes, welcome.
Okay, let's take our next caller. It looks like Calvin from South Carolina.
Go ahead.
Go right ahead, Calvin. Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, hi, this is Beverly and Calvin Gilchrist. We just sent some papers off to you, I guess, last Wednesday, and we did a forum last Thursday, and we were just wondering how long it would take to get a response because our property is up, my estate is up to be sold on January the 4th. So I'm just wondering how long it'll take to hear a response back.
Okay, I think it was you that sent us a paper in the mail with a donation and asking, you know, to I spoke with Jan about you today, and he should have flipped the switch so you have access to the other course, the main course. You have access to all the courses anyway without giving us a donation, but we do ask $5 a month or more for those to take the government by consent course. And hopefully, you know, they've been shutting down a lot of our videos, so a lot of our videos don't seem to be working on our site much anymore. Some are still up, but a lot of them are down. They're still out on YouTube, but we can't, the embedding part is not working. It's not embedding. Mm-hmm. And we'll see if, maybe there's an error on our side somewhere. I don't know how that could be. But that would affect our civil course if because that's very, very heavily on reliable on videos and some audios and so on. But anyway, as far as your situation, I told Jan we're going to try to call you this week and talk to you a little bit about the situation. So we do have your phone number. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, sir. All right. Okay.
Thank you. Okay, let's take our next caller. And you got a question for Robert or any other question? Let's see. It's a Liberty 2. You got the mic. Go right ahead. And anybody wants to get into the queue, it's a star 6 and a 1. But go ahead, Liberty.
Okay. Hi. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Now, I just had a question. I had signed the petition. Just wanted to know what is the turnaround time for that, for the confirmation to go to the email, because I haven't received that yet.
Okay, that's a problem. Go ahead, Robert. I think you should check with your tech guy on that, Robert.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm down here, my wife's with me, and so, of course, I signed it, you know, the first one, and so to test this, my wife just signed it, and the confirmation verification hasn't come through yet, and when I finished talking with Jay, we decided, so it's possible, I'll tell you, this took off like wildfire just today. And before the call tonight, I called it up, and they were coming in. I get a notice about each signature. I get the person's name and address, and they were coming in like wildfire. So I'll have to check with the host.
Your system could have tripped. We've had that problem here. Occasionally, you know, one doesn't get through, but a little lately, come on, it goes through. But the system could have tripped somehow, and I'm not technical enough on it, but you need to talk with your tech on that, yeah.
I'll give our tech guy, I don't know if he's gone to bed, I'll give him a call and let him know what the issue is and let him look into it. But, Jay, It may be on on our end, and the young lady that just raised the issue again. It seems like the system maybe got overloaded. And anyway, we'll go right to work on it. I talked to them today, the people that are hosting this website, and they said there's no problem, no matter what the bandwidth, the gigabytes that's required, it's there if we need it. But something's caused this this glitch, and my sense is it just got it's got to catch up.
Well, bring it up to your tech, because if it trips out, it's not going. I don't think it's going to all of a sudden kick them out tomorrow. 20, 30, 50, 100 emails that should have gone out. So you want to double check on that. Anybody who signs in tonight, and if you don't get through and you have the same problem, before notifying us, wait till tomorrow and try it again. And if tomorrow, let's say by noontime tomorrow, if you still have that problem, send us an email at mail@nationallibertyalliance.org. That's mail@nationallibertyalliance.org. And then we'll notify Robert of what's going on still, and we'll see how things go.
Okay, and then so I just wanted to make sure, because it only has two asterisks on there, which is basically for the name and the email address. Are you suggesting we fill it completely out with our regular address and everything, and the name and email address? Because it only has the asterisks for the email and the name. But I'm wondering if, because I only did email and name.
Robert?
Yeah, let me, hold on, let me see what she's talking about. I'm going to call this up. Oh, where is it? All right, so I'm having... I'm looking for your site, John, and I can't seem to... Oh, here.
NationalLibertyAlliance.org.
I've got it. Okay. So, hang on just a minute. It's coming up. All right. So now we're going down. So I'm at the sign-in page. What's your question, ma'am?
Okay, so I did sign... I signed in and stuff, and... It just, you know, where you fill in all the fields, it says all the required fields, right? So, you know, there's an asterisk by the name field, and there's a red asterisk by email. Now, generally, when I see that, I think, okay, those are the two pertinent ones to fill out in order for this thing to go through. But my question is, do I need to fill all of the fields out in order for it to activate?
Question. I see the reason to your question. First blush, it does look like the only required is your name and email.
Okay.
And then check the box under confirmation. That's necessary. It should be the address as well. I will have to have our tech person asterisk that. It's a good idea for us to know. I don't know. I don't know what the history of that is. Why did I choose not to? I think we need the name and address. So yes, fill out all the fields, please.
Okay.
Yeah, talk with your tech on that because you should put an asterisk next to it if it's a requirement, Robert. And
John.
I'll do that.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Robert, I just signed in. I just signed it, and it sent me a confirmation email, but it sent it to my junk. It went into my junk.
Oh, junk. Okay, let me check my junk.
I went in there and clicked on it, and it confirmed it. So it did work.
Did you fill out all the information, Gerard?
I mean,
name, address, phone number, everything?
Whatever came up, it auto-filled it, but yeah, it had my address. I don't know if my phone number was in there, but whatever was in the memory of my auto-fill.
Yeah, no phone number. They didn't ask for the phone.
It went to junk.
It went into the junk folder, and it came within a minute of me signing it, so.
All right. Yep, it's in my junk.
There you go. See, so everybody.
Okay, everybody check your junk.
Check your junk. Check your junk, man.
Check the junk in the trunk.
Okay, anything else? We'll move to the next caller.
That was all
better.
Right.
I'm signed on now.
Right, thank you very much. All right, let's take another caller, and hopefully we're going to move over to Brent in a few, but we got two more callers. Hartford, Connecticut, what's your first name?
John out of Connecticut.
How you doing, John? Go right ahead.
I wanted to say I signed a thing about 20 minutes ago, and it went through straight away for me. It didn't go into
did,
my
did job. You fill out all the information or just what the aspergers said? Where the
no,
aspergers
I filled out everything.
You know, that may be a requirement to fill everything. So everybody should fill it. It's not much. They're asking for your mailing address, your state, your email, and, your, of course, your name, first and last. And then don't forget, you got to click that confirmation.
Yeah. So. No, mine went through straight and didn't go into junk or anything, but I got it right away.
And, yeah, I just found my wife in our spam folder. I just found my wife showed up in the spam folder.
Okay.
There you go.
It looks like that's the problem then, for most of us anyway, except Jay.
I got to say that it was extremely hard to find on the website. It took me about 10 minutes to find it. I don't know if you guys want to possibly.
Now, when you say to find it, you mean from our site to his site, or when you got onto the site to find the right thing to click to get to the petition to sign?
Well, from your site to his site.
Okay, do you have a browser? Well, actually, it's on every page on the right side. Right, Robert, you know, right now on our website, what we've got is it says, let's see what it says. We wrote down a signed petition to prevent election fraud. Is that the best way to word that, or is there a better wording?
I purposely stayed away from the using the word fraud in the petition. To me,
okay.
Fraud is a willful violation, and I would rather put, you know, give these officials the benefit of the doubt, and you know, maybe they didn't know about the elective clause. Anyway, so it's just it should just talk about violations of election violations.
So prevent election violations.
Yes.
Signed petition to prevent election violations. Does that sound good?
Yes.
Okay. So that's why I'll change that tonight. Violations. But again,
wait a minute. I'm sorry, John. Not to prevent, but to overcome.
Because overcome.
This will overcome the violations.
Okay.
Overcome election violation.
Okay, I got a note on that, and I'll take care of that. Meanwhile, you know, again, it's on every single page of our website. It's on the right-hand side. It's towards the top. It's just right under the book, Government by Consent, and then that's where you see it, and then after that is YouTube. I'll see if I can't get something an icon or something that might be helpful to kind of give it a little more of a...
Verification comes through, it'll say webmaster submission received. That might be something else. Thank you for your submission. If people have continued problems, I'm going to talk to our tech guy, and anybody has continued problems, get hold of John or I or myself. All right.
Yeah, we'll let you know if we start getting complaints or problems, and then we'll let you know, and we'll try to collect those individuals' information. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, anything else you want to bring up, John?
Continuing on this, I don't know if you want maybe put it in red or even put Trump's name in to get people to kind of realize exactly what this thing is for.
Okay, yeah, well, you know, anybody that's got an idea, if you got an idea, think this out. Anybody that's got an idea to help make this a little more obvious and clearer, think it out, and if you got, and we try to keep it to minimal words. We don't want to put a whole paragraph in here, but, we can run a few lines. Anybody think of good words to put to make the point here, you can send your suggestions to mail, M-A-I-L, at nationallibertyalliance.org, and we'll try to hammer something out that is a little more clearer, okay?
Good. On another note, with the media being as just insane as they are, with all the lies. The First Amendment, from what I understand, from what I get from it, is you have the freedom of speech and freedom of press, but you are liable for what you say. Am I wrong?
Liable for what you say is freedom of speech, you mean?
Right.
Well, of course, if it's something that injures another individual in some way, I mean, it's got to be, you know, a real injury. And of course, you under common law, you're liable for anybody you injure. I mean, words, generally speaking, don't injure people unless they're destructive to our way, our common law, our founding documents. There is even U.S. Code. You know, you can't take your position and start to teach and hand out literature for the purpose of turning our nation, our country, into a Marxist or a communist nation. That's an assault upon the Constitution, and that's a crime. And right. And especially anyone who took an oath, and we've been taking oaths since we started school. I'm sure, hopefully, they still do the Pledge of Allegiance in school, but that's an oath right there. I pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic for which it stands. So we as citizens, as people born in this nation or people who have become citizens, moved here from other countries, we take that oath on a daily basis. And again, it's against the law to do anything to try to destroy our republic. And especially for those people who are elected and took that oath of office, and then they use their platform to bring forth Marxism or to destroy our First Amendment or our Second Amendment, which is what they've been doing. So, yeah, that's a crime. And we, the people, need to wake up to that, and so do our representatives need to wake up to that. And we've got to start holding people responsible, and we're going to start indicting these people, and we need to put them in jail. More than half of Congress belongs in jail, unfortunately, and it's a shame.
To be honest with you, I think as deep as it is right now, I only see one real fix to this is to actually remove them and start.
Well, that's what's going to happen. This is too big and too deep. I think this is subversion against the United States of America. This is a coup. There's a lot more going on than just the election. I mean, this thing is huge. The problems and the violations of law, an assault upon our way of life, our founding documents, trying to change us into something else, denying who we are and teaching that. And you look at the news media, the fake news, and they're not really putting the real news out. This is a conspiracy and subversion, and I really don't see any other way to get around it but using the military for arrests. I'm not talking about a military violence in the streets, which, of course, some that may break out here or there, and I would imagine mostly in cities. But I know Q had mentioned the talk about this, as they will snuff that out very quickly. So, you know, if we come in, if the president decides to go that route, and I'll tell you what, even after the election is won, if he can win it through the courts or he can win it through the legislators or the states, if he can win it that way, fine. But he's still going to need the military to make the arrest, I think. There's too many of them. There's not just hundreds. There's not just thousands. There's hundreds of thousands of people involved in this conspiracy. And I don't know if anybody heard the interview that took place on Epoch Times with, what's his name? He was the guy that worked with to help get Trump elected originally. What was his name?
Bannon.
Bannon. Yes, Bannon. That interview was just this evening. I just was able to see the whole interview before we started the program tonight. And he gets into a lot of the details of how deep this this conspiracy is, and the major corporations working with China and a few other nations. Russia may be amongst that. It seems that Russia is involved to some degree with it too. So it's huge. And, so there are foreign countries trying to take Trump out and to get rid of our Constitution. And there are many, 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 many people, domestic enemies, within our government to take our nation down. And there's, it needs to be stopped. These people need to be arrested. They need to be put in jail, and some of them need to hang. I mean, that, of course, will be the decision of the jury. And I think it's going to be, a lot of it's going to be military, a military courts, in my opinion. But we'll see. You know, let's see what Trump does.
I really hope so, because it's common sense. You can see it. It's deep, and it's...
And our Justice Department, we have too many problems with the FBI and even other three-letter agencies, and we have problems in the states. They're real major problems, and it's failing across the whole spectrum here of everything that we're doing. It seems to be failing everywhere. The courts are failing us, and everything. But something must be done, because if nothing is done. And Trump did leave the office, and I don't believe he's going to leave office. He feels he has a duty to have to do something to fix this, because we'll all be done. We'll see the last president of the United States, Biden and his vice president, and I don't think we'll have a constitution by the end of their term, and I don't think we'll have a president anymore. I think we'll be just locked down just like the rest of the world is. We're wearing masks and all other kind of problems, taking our weapons. You know, this woman, Kamala, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name right. You know, she's talking about her and Biden, that they should do an executive order as soon as he gets in office to deal with the Second Amendment. Can you imagine that, an executive order to get rid of the Second Amendment? That's unbelievable. But that's how bad it is. We can't allow this to stand.
In this country that own firearms that are dead set on fighting.
We can't let it stand. Well, I don't think Trump's going to allow it to get to that point. I believe Trump's going to take care of it. He's already got the military dispersed around. He's got plenty of aircraft in the area, up in the air, around America. And he's not. Nobody's talking about that. Few people are reporting and wondering what that's all about. But, something's happening.
I'm sure you're right. I got to say, it's been tiring to see every other day that, big news, big this coming, couple days. It's coming in a couple days. I've heard that for weeks now. And
look at frustration levels have to build up. People who don't understand what's going on, enough problems have to hit the airways and hit the people and affect their lives so that the people see and the people understand. And that's the key to this whole thing. And, yeah, it has been long and waiting. It's been 3-4 years now, long and waiting. And, but the whole thing, the people have to see. You can't tell the people because they're not going to believe you. You're just another conspiracy theorist. So the people have to see. And look what just happened this year. The people are seeing. No doubt about it. All right, do you have any other question or a comment that you might want to ask Robert or anything? We've got a few other people in the queue here.
I'll just leave it at that for now. I will kind of want to study your courses there and get to know a little bit more about what you guys do.
Well, if you go onto our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, on the blue bar, you highlight the People's Duty tab. And you want to look at all that stuff. We're dealing with the militia, reconstructing the militia. We're looking at bringing administrations to the juries, back to the people, and take it away from the courts, where the people have the control of calling the juries together, orientating them, and to bring it back under common law, where the only individual that has the authority to go before a grand jury are the people themselves, number one, of course, but the sheriff. If the government wants to bring any kind of an issue before a grand jury, whether it's federal or whether it's within a state, still has to be done within a county. And that county sheriff has got to be the individual to look at what the concern is that they want to bring before the jury and make a decision whether he's going to bring that to the jury or not, because we've got to stop all these quote-unquote ham sandwiches coming out of the jury rooms, these grand jury rooms, because they wine and dine them, so to speak, and they get what they want. They convince them to get their you know, their indictment. And then, of course, once they're in the court, the judge convinces the jury to focus in on statutes and codes. And that has nothing to do with common law, natural law, at all. Codes and statutes violate, all those things apply to government agents and agencies. Yeah, go ahead.
Johnny, I gotta sign off. This is Bob.
Okay, Robert.
Yeah,
thanks for coming on. It was a good call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
All right, Godspeed, and have a blessed Christmas there, Robert.
Yes, you do the same. Stay well.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Okay. All right. You know, we're so close to the end, we may not get to you, Brent, unless you want to speak for maybe 10 minutes, and then we'll try to get to the rest of the people in the queue.
Okay. Brent?
Yeah, if you want to take 10 minutes or so, and then we'll try to get to the rest of the people in the queue, right?
All right. Real quickly, then. Thank you. Again,
thank you.
My name is Brent. Alan Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And my comments are my own couple of things that struck my mind as Mr. Schultz was talking. Number one, the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution of the United States. The Supremacy Clause, Article 6. The supremacy of what? The supremacy of the law of the land. It is the supreme, the Constitution of the United States, says the Constitution, is the supreme law of the land. What does that mean? Sounds simple, you say, Brent. Easy, it's the supreme law. Well, if it is, it certainly doesn't cover everything. It doesn't talk about rape, the penalties for kidnapping, murder, manslaughter, burglary. It doesn't govern or say anything about the law of contracts, the law of family relationships, the law of trusts, the law of wills and testaments. Doesn't say anything about any of those things, plus a whole lot more, corporation law. It doesn't give us any of the details about, even though it mentions juries, it doesn't say how they're impaneled. It doesn't say how that our militia is to operate, except with four brief clauses, which are good, but doesn't say much. And the reason is because the phrase law of the land doesn't refer to all those things. The phrase law of the land, taken from Magna Carta, mentioned a while ago, the year 1215, and that phrase Magna Carta from the year 1215, Lex Terra, it's written in Latin, translates law of the land, or land law, probably is a more accurate way to translate it, land law. That is the phrase that those folk over there in Britain had used for a few hundred years at least. Watch me. They had used that phrase to denote due process, the way things are supposed to be done. When the Constitution of the United States says that it is the supreme law of the land, that means nothing is to trump the way it says things are supposed to be done. And our Constitution of the United States primarily and foremost, preeminently, is a document telling us how things are supposed to be done. Not what's supposed to be done, no. How, H-O-W, it's supposed to be done. Well, that means that when it says that the state legislature shall establish the rules for elections of the president, specifically, the state legislatures, that means that some rogue governor isn't allowed to change those rules, or some judge, some federal judge, some state judge say, no, it's all right to have some ballots come in late. You can read that petition. It's got it all there. But again, it comes back to how things are to be done, not what is to be done. Matter of fact, how things are to be done is the holy of holies of our common law tradition. Beyond that, how things are to be done is our common law tradition. Our common law is not about setting end result standards. Our common law is due process. That's what it is. Due process. Fundamentally, how things are to be done. And that's what we're complaining about here. You see, the Supreme Court of the United States said, well, Mr. Texas Attorney General, Mr. Missouri Attorney General, and about 15 other states at least, and others that supported them, something like 31, the Supreme Court said, you don't have standing to bring this case. You're saying that the proper procedure wasn't followed for the elections. That's what you're saying. But you didn't show us that you were, that the state of Texas was damaged. You have to show some kind of harm to have standing. We don't deal with non-bloody plaintiffs. If you're going to come in here and complain and moan about something that happened to you, you got to show us some injury. We got to see some blood running down the back of your neck or your leg. And you haven't even alleged that you have any. So they threw it out. Listen, when I go into court, as I've done, and I say, wait a minute, my client wasn't served process, that piece of paper, process. He wasn't properly served. He didn't receive notice and an opportunity to be heard. Like the federal marshals come and throw it down on the fence row and say they served him, or they go to his relative's house and hand it to them. That's the kind of thing that goes on. And we come back and say, wait a minute, nope, can't go any further. You didn't serve him. Now, what are we complaining about there? We're not complaining about what's being done. We're complaining about how it's being done. We're complaining about the process, the way things are done, W-A-Y, the manner in which people conduct themselves when they do a certain thing. You got to do it a certain way. And when I say that someone wasn't served process, I don't have to show harm. Why? Because due process is the holy of holies of the law of the land. And our Constitution is a brief of common law government. And common law government is not about what is to be done. It doesn't stress end result. It stresses the process. It sticks us to the process. It keeps its nose paying attention to how we're doing it. The Supreme Court is wrong. Not ambiguously wrong. No, not even a little bit. Just flat wrong. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist or a college graduate to see it. No, the way things are to be done. We ask that government go through the modest inconvenience of following due process. If you're going to change the way your state in Georgia or Michigan or Wisconsin or anywhere, Texas, the way you see to it that electors are presented and votes are taken of the popular vote, then you must follow the modest inconvenience of letting the legislature do that and don't allow the governor or some judge someplace to do it. Why are these judges doing this? Why? Why are governors of states acting with such overt, blatant disregard of what everything and everybody, including the law itself, demands of them? We've never seen this before. Are they being threatened? Are they being bribed? Are they being blackmailed? Three questions. I say all three have to be true at this point. Either one or a combination of them. And having been in politics a little, I know that blackmail is the name of the game, and I don't mean a little bit. The Chinese are all over us. They've infected. Like snakes and virus, they crept into our system. And, having done that, I'm fully convinced that they have gathered enough information to blackmail a whole lot of Americans in upfront positions and threaten them. That's what blackmail is, I suppose. A species of threatening people. So we're in a tough situation. What are you going to do? You going to put a diaper on your head again when you go to the store? Wake up, boys and girls, and smell the coffee. The commies are back. But this time they're back with deceit and poison. Well, I don't think they'll win. Let me tell you what I think could happen, then we'll quit. You know, DJ Trump hasn't conceded yet. Now, you got to believe, you got to conclude that he hasn't conceded for a reason. And I believe that's true. And what is the reason? Well, he knows if he doesn't concede, at some point, if some judge says, no, this has not been a square election. We've been done false here. If some judge says that, then there is now a case before the Supreme Court, or a couple of them, maybe three. If some judge does that, that's going to throw the election over to the House of Representatives. And the 12th Amendment of our Constitution says, if that happens, then each state of the United States, of the 50 states, gets one vote for president. Each state gets one vote. And if that state has more members of the House of Representatives that are Republican than are Democrats, then that state's going to cast one vote for Trump.
Didn't he pull 31 states, Brent?
Who, Trump?
Yeah. How many states did he pull?
Yeah, that's right. That'd be right.
So there you go.
Well, if that happens, and I'm not a prophet, I'm just a predictor of probabilities like a lot of other people. He's not conceding because he's been advised not to, and the people that have run the possibilities out see this 12th Amendment of our Constitution to possibly be an important element in what might happen. Well, thank you much, John, for letting me say a few words. I'm not discouraged. We are at war, but shucks, we've always been at war. The only difference now is they have come out of the woodwork. They've been hiding. Now they're not hiding.
It used to be covert. Now it's overt.
Good,
absolutely.
Good choice of words. Easy to remember, too. Covert versus overt. Well, thank you, John, and back to you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Brent. Okay, let's take some more questions here. We're coming close to the end. We have two more people in the queue. If anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1.
I got a question. That Supreme Court decision not to hear the case and to say they didn't have standing, was that unanimous, or was did a couple of them vote against it?
7-2.
7-2. So
Thomas and Alito were four, you know, being heard. All five, and the other five said, no way, that's surprising. But there must be something else going there that I don't know what this is all about. I hate this no standing business, though. That's really...
That Amy Coney Barrett voted with the...
Well, apparently, only two justices wanted to hear it.
Wow.
And you got Kavanaugh also didn't go that right way. There's three of them that, Trump put in, and all three of them went the opposite way. But you know what? I think they're waiting and hoping for exactly what Brent is talking about, moving it to the point where each state, because that's going to be the final decision maker, and each state gets that one vote, and Trump will win. And I think that is what Trump is holding out for. And until that happens, or if it doesn't happen, then there's a different thing he's got to do. And I think it's and no matter what happens, once he gets elected, if he gets elected that way, I don't believe there's any way to get away from this. Military is going to get involved in this because the arrests are so massive and so huge, and it's got to be military. And all these people are part of, or most of these people are part of government. They're enemies from within. And a military trial for them seems to be the right thing. And Kavanaugh spoke about this when he was asked by Lindsey.
Well, first of all, we are under an emergency act, and we know that there was foreign influence, so that puts it under the military.
That ends the whole thing right there.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. And the other thing is if the Supreme Court would have opened those cases up and read them, which I'm sure they know what's in there was evidence of treason and sedition. So as a Supreme Court judge, I don't care if they think you have standing or don't have standing. There's evidence in there that they need to look into, but they ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they have that option. You see, that, in other words...
Well, again, you know, I think they're hoping more for the electors to work it out. And again, if that doesn't happen, there's still a little time for the... final word for the United States Supreme Court to deal with, and I think maybe they'll listen then and hear then, because look at to really really make this a smooth transition, it really needs to be done in a much more lawful way in the sense of either the electors or the Supreme Court. I'd prefer the electors, as Brent was talking about, but we'll take of course the Supreme Court decision, and the other thing of course is in those 7 questionable states. The idea or the thought would be that the military would run the elections in those states over.
Well, I'll go one further for you. I believe that the Supreme Court didn't want the weight of this whole election on their shoulders.
But that doesn't matter. Then they're not Supreme Court. They're not justices. They should all be gotten rid of if that's the problem.
I think they were all threatened, John. I think they were said, if you vote for...
Well, hey, they decided to take on this job. They knew what was going to be in it. Look at what we're doing. We decided to do what we're doing, and some of us could be in jeopardy, but it is what we're doing. We've done it. And either we're going to continue... or not. So they need to resign if they can't be just judges.
I think it's going to end up back in front of them, and the next time it's in front of them, they're going to have no choice because they're going to be obvious seditioners. So that way there they can say, look, we tried to throw it out, they brought it back, there's nothing we could do. You see what I'm saying?
Well, again, it's the way it has to be couched, and I think Trump has another way of couching it, and I think that's going to happen after the 6th. Was it the 6th or the 5th at their meeting? I think it was the 6th, wasn't it?
I think it's
so he's going to wait till after that. I think
that's when they count the electoral college votes on the 6th, right?
Right, and you got the dueling electors. You got congressmen and senators that are willing to force a debate, and at the end of that debate, they can force it into the constitutional decision, which is let the states decide one vote per state. Just as Brent had mentioned, and we have at least, I think it's 31 states that he won. So I truly believe he won most of the states. I actually think he won New York and California.
California, they said he won California by 86%.
It's insane what's taking place. Yeah, but the bottom line, this really has to be investigated no matter to the fullest extent, and that's going to be part of the subversion problem that we have with enemies domestic, and look at, I think a lot of our indictments are going to be appreciated back in that time. We're working on paperwork to update that, and if it doesn't, then we're going to try to force it through. They have to acknowledge we the people. We came together, we did indictments, and they were valid indictments, and they were mostly on judges and prosecutors who work together to deny due process, to transfer people, hijack people into jurisdictions unknown, and in many cases put people in jail, and they refuse to take on and listen to habeas corpus. These people are criminals. They belong in jail. We the people need to make sure that happens.
Well, thank God we have U.S. versus Williams to give us a...
Well, amen. That's a powerful paper.
Right.
All right, let's take a few callers here. We got Jim from PA. Go right ahead, Jim. You got the mic? We're not going to be able to spend too much time because it's getting late, but Jim from Pennsylvania, 412.
We put him to sleep.
Yeah. Jim from Pennsylvania, last call.
Okay, I'm here.
Go right ahead, Jim. You got the mic.
Hey, I'll be very brief. I believe the Texas suit to the Supreme Court I think Brent was saying that that was correct. And my understanding is that Texas did not have standing because they were not the injured party. Had Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, or one of those other states that had the vote, the true confirmed, but the alleged voter fraud, I think they would have gave an opinion on that.
Well, I disagree with that conclusion, and I'll tell you why. Texas has so many votes to put forward for the election of the presidency, and when fraud takes place in a state, that just overturns their vote. It destroys their vote. And when you have seven states that are all fraudulent and steal the election, it affects Texas. And I don't care. Look, there was quite a few states that signed on with them. I think it was 17 or 18. It might have even been more. And I'm sure if things continued on, a lot more states would have come on. But nevertheless, look, at Texas is a sovereign state. They have a right to be heard. The people of Texas and the state representing those people, they have a right to be heard, and they have a right to not have to lose the value of their vote to fraud. In a republic, one person, one individual has a right to stand against everybody. There is no way any court should be able to say to any individual, and I believe the states also, to say, you don't have standing because maybe you don't have enough people or whatever. I have no idea what's in their mind. I've been in this for, 12, 13 years now?
Yeah,
I still don't have a clue on what the standing business is.
Look, Brent made a very, very important point that we're all missing here. When it comes to due process, you don't need standing.
Right.
When they violate due process by letting a judge change the law or this or that and not sending it to the legislator, I don't care where you are. You can bring that up, and you don't have to have standing.
When a right is violated, that you have all the standing in the world.
So that whole thing goes out the window when you're talking about due process. As a matter of fact, Scalia said that most of the abuses in the federal courts are in the states that go to the federal courts have to do with due process.
Gentlemen, let me jump in for 1 minute, and
go right ahead.
I just want to make one more comment. If you watch the U.S. Senate hearings on it was the Homeland Security Committee discussing voter fraud. I think it was aired live on C-SPAN and here in Pennsylvania on PBS.
I watched a good part of it.
Okay,
yeah.
I think that told it all. But as far as the standing or not, I'm going to yield, and I'll let you discuss. And I want to listen, but I wanted to. I just think viewing that Homeland Security Committee was very informative, particularly what Rand Paul had to say. I'll yield.
I think there's enough evidence out there at this point, with all the hearings we've had and stuff, to say that you can't depend on the results of this election. I think there's enough crap that went on that you could pretty much say, look at. You have to throw it out because we don't know what votes were right. We know there was fraud. Even if we don't know the extent of it, we know it was large. It was large enough to call the election into doubt. So it needs to go to the legislators, to the states.
Yeah,
I don't know how else we can fix it.
The unfortunate thing is the entire federal judiciary is totally corrupt. Totally corrupt. There are a handful of judges that, and unfortunately none in our area. I mean, we have to go all the way out west to find one in a case that took place. I think it was It might have been in Colorado. I mean, the Stephen Dean case, what was that? Was that in Colorado?
Utah.
Okay. Back, all the way out to Utah, there's a judge out there that stood up for us. And, I mean, that's how far we got to go to find the judge, and that's pretty sad. I don't look at you want anybody that wants to debate the standing issue. it's a one-sided argument, because the side that claims that there is no standing is just silent. They say the words and they give no interpretation on their meetings and why and what nothing. They just say, you don't have standing. Case closed. You're out of here. They do the same thing with Rule 12. You know, failure to state a claim, or I forget exactly how it's worded, but generally that's
that
it.
That relief can be given, yeah.
Right. I mean, look, we've had some extremely, I think all of our cases, extremely powerful, and a lot of them have been thrown out on Rule 12. We won a case right now through default, okay, and they brought it back into the court, and now the other side is coming back with a Rule 12 to throw us out. And that U.S. attorney defaulted. They defaulted. We wrote the default. We sent in an affidavit of default, and then the judge not only struck it, but literally removed it. You could strike it, judge, but you can't remove it from the docket. But it's removed. They removed it from the docket so nobody could see their crime. But we saw their crime, and we have their crime recorded, and we're taken into a different direction, and we did indict that judge, by the way. But this is what they're evil. The whole system is just evil. It's all these judges, they just got to go. And we'll work real hard to try to name these judges and get them out there to the Justice Department when the Justice Department finally returns to justice again. But with that, let's take our next call. You got any other statements, or are we going to go to our next caller?
No. All right, go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. Jay, we'll take you real quick. Go right ahead, Jay.
Okay, I was just going to say I tried to redo the petition, and I didn't get anything in my spam folder or anything. Gerard, who did the email come from?
It came from, hang on, I'll tell you in a second here.
And then I want to say something about the Texas case, too.
Well, while he's looking, go ahead, say something.
Okay, it came from Occupy the Constitution.
Okay, all right, yeah, I haven't gotten anything from them in any of my, I've looked all through my email.
And you did it again tonight. You did it yesterday, yep. And did it tonight.
Yep.
That's strange.
Because I did it after everybody else said they did it, and I couldn't find it in spam, so I thought, okay, let's do it again and see if it goes to spam right away.
And you filled everything out and checked the box,
yep,
right?
Filled everything out and checked the box, and I got the little green confirmation thing that said I need to check my email.
Right. All right, we'll try again tomorrow, let's see, and send us an email if you don't get it. And anybody else can't get through, send us an email. And then
maybe I need to log on to a computer and quit trying to do it on my phone.
Well, yeah, you know, you should be able to do it through your phone, though.
Yeah. Anyway, my understanding on the Texas case was that the delegates hadn't confirmed their counts yet, so Texas basically wasn't injured at that point.
Well, yeah, that may be a point. They're not injured until the 5th or the 6th, if they are injured at that point in time.
Well, they weren't injured at the time. The states hadn't confirmed their counts yet. The state, you know, and
right,
that happened. Okay, they filed it before that. But then
but
I heard
Robert.
Is
that the conclusion that the Supreme Court gave? And
well,
you know
they
what,
said they didn't have standing because they weren't injured yet.
But what's surprising to this whole thing is two of the longest standing, I don't want to call them conservatives because I really don't like that. I'd rather say constitutionalists. Alito and Thomas, they wanted to take the case.
We need to get the
decisions on that from both sides and see one. Has anybody read the decisions on both sides?
Well, Roberts was screaming at everybody and told the two junior justices that they had to vote the way he told them to vote.
Well, regardless, regardless of whether the votes were counted or whatever you call it, what you just said about
it's the fraud that's obvious.
Well, it's the due process. Doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
But anyway,
well, you know what? Yeah, you're right. You're right. They didn't get. They were injured because you know why? Because they didn't follow the laws of the state.
That's right. And they let a judge change the thing. Their due process was, and the Supreme Court knows that. They're not stupid.
Right.
Yeah,
but,
so that's
but,
seven judges. I have no idea why they went the way they did.
But Alito wrote in his dissenting opinion they put the case in under Article 2. Alito wrote in his dissenting opinion, Article 3 is where you need to be. So if they refile that case under Article 3, they can't deny it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that would bring us, let's see. Well, that would bring us to the judicial powers that extending. Did they say where in Article 3?
He didn't, but you should read Alito's decision because.
Yeah, I'm gonna, can you email me a copy or a link to a copy?
I don't have a link to a copy. I just heard that on a radio show.
Okay, I'm going to look
at that. Alito wrote in his decision, Article 3 is where you need to be. So he was telling the Trump administration or whoever, you know, he was giving them the remedy. He was telling them what they need to do.
Right. I'll look that up. Maybe we could talk about that next week a little bit and see what I can find. Thanks,
okay,
Jay.
That's all I had.
Okay, we got one last caller. Is that Sean from Illinois? Wait, let me see. Where is that? Illinois?
Yeah, this is Illinois. Sean from Illinois.
Okay.
Yeah, you can say ill and noise because that's all we got here, man.
I don't know if it's an Eastern thing or what, but I've always heard Illinois. But I heard people correct that and say, no, it's Illinois.
I just go with it, that ill and noise, because you get chemtrails everywhere and noise of, you know. Anyways, just real quick, I know it's late, been listening in to, I think it was Robert with Occupy the Constitution.
Yeah, but that's Robert Schultz with We the People. He's been one of the most active people in the Liberty Movement that I know of, and he's been working in the courts trying to do things with these problems, with the right to redress of grievances, since at least 1999.
Yeah. He's one of the new founding fathers, I think. Yeah. But
he got the Continental Congress going and got that going. Michael Bodnarik was the president of the Continental Congress, and 48 of the 50 states, or 57 if you're with Barack Obama on this, but anyway, 48 states went and was represented, and they came out with the Articles of Freedom, which we do have up on our website. You can find that under Education. We've got a lot of documents under that. And it's a 63 or 64-page document. I remember when it was released. It was released on Christmas Eve, and I was watching for it, and it finally was released on Christmas Eve, and I stayed up late that night and read through that document. It was fascinating. You know, the big thing is a lot of the people involved with them, they did, and including Robert at the time at least, lacked a lot of the knowledge of the common law, and I think some of the things could have been said a little better or in a different way that's more in a common law, couching, so to speak. But nevertheless, powerful document, good work, and they ignored it all. They ignored it all. Third Continental Congress met in 2009. In Illinois, I believe. Wasn't it in Illinois? Gerard, didn't they meet out there? Do you remember where they met?
I don't remember.
I think it was Illinois. I don't remember, too, but I'm not sure. Anyway.
That's awesome. Yeah, just the question was, he's gone now, but I was looking everything up, and I was reading his PDF on the Electoral College Votes and Party. I don't see Illinois at all in there, and am I wrong to say that, our governor signed SB 863 and HB 2238 into law requiring the local election? Our governor required the local election to deliver vote by mail. So doesn't this...
Well, he can't do that without the legislature. You know,
right,
again,
yeah.
These people are doing things by executive order. The governors, presidents have been doing this for a long time, things that are wrong. Even President Trump is doing it, but he's doing it, he's using it because they've used it, but he's using it to save the nation. Okay? But these governors, you know, they're putting out these executive orders, and they have no power or authority to change the law by executive order. I mean, this vice, Biden's vice president, Kamala, what's her name, Kamala something or other?
Kamala Harris.
Harris, Kamala Harris. Okay, she's saying that Biden needs to do an executive law order to deal with the Second Amendment. I mean, is this woman insane?
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
Is she insane?
I don't even call her vice president. That's another reality, you know.
That's war. That's war against the people.
Exactly.
Because there has never, ever, ever, ever been a nation, a country, or anything anywhere in this world, at least in the last 150 years or so, that when they took the guns away from the people, that they didn't go out and kill millions. It happened over and over again. In the 20th century alone, I forget how many million. It was a huge number, like 35, 45 million people were killed by their own government. And one of the first things they did was starting to make laws to prevent guns, to restrict the weapons, guns, and then at some point to get rid of them altogether. And then they came out and killed the people. Germany did it. Russia did it.
I don't think the American military will go along with it. They make smart bombs for dumb people.
That's right. Well, no, the people will never go for that. No, you're right. The militia will be up in arms. It's done.
There's too many people, and especially, you know, in Illinois, everywhere I talk to in Illinois, that there's just even people and lawyers that, like, speak out, and they're afraid to speak out, but I talk to. But my question is, like, should I just email Robert, or his name's Bob, on his website, because I don't see my state on this PDF to sign the petition. So what, should I just wait for his response?
Well, why don't you send him an email? It's Bob at. Goodness, I got to look that up.
Give me liberty.
GiveMeLiberty.org. I am on his website.
That is it. Yes, I think that is
okay.
Bob at GiveMeLiberty.org, and bring that issue up to him. I'm sure he'll respond back to you.
All right, very good.
We're working
That's all I
with
got.
Bob, and we're working with others. We're working with groups of sheriffs. Which, by the way, Jan. That sheriff out there in Pennsylvania, is he connected up with the Michigan sheriffs and others that are getting together trying to re-educate the sheriffs and make a stand for the Constitution? Jan, if you're still here, I hope. Or did we lose Jan?
Well, that was my only question. I'm going to yield on that, gentlemen, and I'm going to take off.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Sean.
Yeah, we're going to end up. Do you got anything final to say, Gerard?
No, I'm good.
Okay, we're going to end it for the evening. I appreciate everyone coming. Lord willing, we'll be back next Monday. And everybody, please, Godspeed, and have a very blessed Christmas to all. Good night.
To all a good night.
Good Christmas. Good night.